From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. College is about to get more expensive across the state. The Nevada Board of Regents voted 8-5 on Friday to approve a 12% increase for universities and upper division courses at community colleges over the next 3 years. Lower division courses will increase by 9%. That amounts to about $1,200 per year for students at public universities and $400 for community college students. Regents approved the increase to cover a roughly $47 million budget shortfall within the Nevada system of higher education. Higher education officials argued that staff raises mandated by state lawmakers were responsible for the budget hole. Here's NC Chancellor Matt McNair explaining the need for the tuition increase.
The proposal is not about expansion, it's about preservation. Predictable pricing, unfortunately, has not delivered the results that we had hoped. The HEPI increase has only applied to 21% of our budget, and so every year the gap grows wider and wider, and that's why we are here today. The presidents have maximized efficiency by holding positions, deferring maintenance in order to protect student services. I do want to say something about the students and families who will be paying for higher education. We recognize that even small increases matter, and that is a very daily, real struggle for a lot of families. We don't take this lightly, we don't make this recommendation lightly, and we know what that means. But this recommendation that we're making is the best that we could do in terms of balancing value and affordability. We are certainly not abandoning affordability. We want our budget to reflect our values. We want our budget to reflect restraint, discipline, responsible stewardship, value, and a continued commitment to affordability and student services. We want people to know that education is a worthy investment. We will do everything that we can to maximize the investment that students and families are making.
As a note, KNPR reached out to NC to join us for this conversation. They declined. However, one person who was at the meeting was KUNR's Lucia Starbuck, and she joins us now. Lucia, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
First and foremost, let's talk about why NC needed this money. They were facing a nearly $47 million budget shortfall. What was going on there?
Yeah, as you mentioned, in 2023, the state legislature approved cost-of-living adjustments, essentially raises for Nevada's public universities and colleges. Lawmakers argued this was necessary. Faculty had not gotten a raise in more than a decade. We were coming out of the pandemic. Staff had to take furloughs. There were hiring freezes. But even though the state required these raises, they A, did not fully cover the costs, and B, they used one-time funding. So it was always destined to run out.
So tuition will increase by up to 12% over the next 3 years. Did NC offer the Board of Regents any alternatives to make up the budget gap other than just letting staff go?
So UNR's President Brian Sandoval said they've tried to cut back on travel costs. There have been some positions have been eliminated. But yeah, it was either raise tuition or about more than 300 jobs were at risk. And during public comment, staff said that could be reductions in library services, counseling, tutoring, things like that.
There was a lengthy public comment period at last week's meeting. What were you hearing, not just from the staff, but from students as well?
I mean, this vote kind of put students and staff against each other. Students were saying they are already struggling with the high cost of living, rent, healthcare. Even KUNR has heard from some students who have moved back in with their parents or dropped out, citing costs. I mean, if you're stretching your budget to the last penny, any increase is going to be really painful. But staff said if you start cutting staff, then they're going to be strained and essentially the product will go downhill. The quality of education will decrease.
You were mentioning it a second ago, but we're talking about NC. But the push to raise tuition was coming from school presidents themselves. They were the ones who were selling the need for more money. They said jobs and student services were on the line. Did they say exactly everything that was on the chopping block?
A lot of the push actually came from faculty saying essentially, do not cut me and my colleagues. And, you know, this is going to be really painful for us. The president essentially said, you know, we have to fill this hole somehow. And the easiest and most quickest way to do that is to raise fees. They promised to go back to the legislature and fight again. But it was really kind of like they said they kind of had no other option. And for UNR, for example, this tuition increase doesn't even fully cover the gap caused.
You know, this was not a unanimous decision from the Board of Regents. As I mentioned a moment ago, the vote was 8-5. What did Regents have to say for themselves?
They said that this was a really difficult decision, one of the most difficult decisions they've had to make, which is interesting, again, coming out of the pandemic when there were other big cuts that had to be made. But you had some regents, including Vice Chair Stephanie Goodman, I mean, literally apologizing during the meeting, saying, "I'm sorry." That's not something you hear during government meetings all the time. But they're like, "We hear you, students, and we're sorry." But again, they had to fill the budget hole somehow. And you had one regent as well saying, "You know, I didn't see any executive cuts." So you can kind of tell by this split vote that some regents weren't happy. I mean, this is kind of when you talk about do politics affect you? These are elected positions. They have to go to the legislature to fight for funding, also elected positions. And there's this fight between the legislature and the regents. So it really comes down to politics. But, you know, some regents said, you know, this is the decision that we had to make. And ultimately, that's what they decided to do.
All right, Lucia, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Since this program airs on KUNR, I should also mention as a note of disclosure that the license for KUNR is owned by the Nevada System of Higher Education. Of course, one group this tuition hike affects more than any other is students. I spoke with Kelechi Odunze. He's the student body president at UNLV. Here's what he had to say. Kelechi, thank you so much for joining me. Let's just dive in. What was the student government's position on this tuition hike?
We opposed it. Our student government wrote a formal resolution and presented it at the Board of Regents meeting. Obviously, it's easy to just say no to tuition increases. As a student, you don't want to hear your tuitions going up. But I think our main concerns, and mine especially, just as a student, was the transparency about it. The proposals seemed very rushed. Also, there wasn't a lot of data about how it would impact students. They just increased tuition 2 years ago in 2023, when I was a first year student in my first semester, for the cost of living adjustment so we could pay our faculty adequately, which we all supported back then. But then they came back just 2 years later saying, "Hey, we're still in a budget gap. We need you guys to increase your tuition again." As a student body president, I get a lot of people coming to me thinking I'm raising tuition, or they tell me their stories because I'm accessible, which I love. But I mean, it's very heavy hearing all the things that people are going through too.
You know, what are you hearing from your constituents?
I'm hearing a lot of people saying they're going to have to drop out or take on an additional job or reduce their course load, which it's really hard. A lot of students are saying they're going to have to take out more loans. And so a lot of people are very concerned. We get it, inflation is increasing, but inflation is also increasing for students as well. When we go to the grocery store, we're paying the same price for those things. A lot of students work, they're paying the same exact taxes. And so people, they've been saying, you know, inflation's rising at this rate and this rate, but we're also feeling it in those other areas too. So it's a lot.
You know, a lot of this comes down to funding, and NSHE still gets quite a bit of their money from state lawmakers, from state appropriations. There's been a pretty open feud between lawmakers and the Board of Regents for decades now over who gets ultimate control over NSHE and over spending. Lawmakers had an opportunity to fill this gap during the 25 session, during the special session in November. They didn't. Do you feel like students are left in the crosshairs here?
Oh, yes. Every time this happens, everybody in EM students are caught in the crosshair. I know not every legislator agrees with every regent, but it's not about their relationships. It's about the students and who is being served through the system. And so, again, I think we could do a better job of saying, hey, it's not the regents who are being affected by this. It's the student body. Regardless if we're turning out in 4 to 6 years, there is still going to be a young individual who is going to be affected by this. And so I think that is something that we could do better on, like I said before. But yeah, we are always caught in the crosshair. And I think it's because we are the least informed. And again, there's such a quick turnover with us too. We're out in 4 years or out in 6 years, whereas administrators are here consistently, faculty's here consistently, the regents are here for six years. And so it's just easy. They say it's not easy, but it is easy to put on students because you can just say, well, they're going to be gone in 4 years. They're going to forget about it.
You know, there's an argument that universities should focus on majors that pay well, that, you know, schools shouldn't be pumping out art majors or social workers, I guess. Is that a valid criticism? Do you think that the university is spending too much money on degree paths that aren't profitable?
I don't think that's true at all. I think our university could use more degrees in those fields. I think it's, you know, obviously engineering is a great degree. That's probably what I'm going to focus on. It makes students a lot of money once they're out. They can get their four-year degree and go make money in the workforce right after. But there's also a lot of value in degrees in the arts and liberal arts too. And having those, and having people who think critically, who have those soft skills built up too. Because although it's great to make money, it's also great to have a community that cares about each other, that is advancing in artwork as well, and things like that. So I feel like we can't just have people who are making money or people who are super analytical. Things advance when we also reinvest in art and fields like that too. So I don't think that's a valid point or a valid argument.
Kelechi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kelechi Odunze is the student body president for the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. As a note, KNPR reached out to Enshi to join us for this conversation. They declined. I should also mention that since this program airs on KUNR, the license for KUNR is owned by the Nevada System of Higher Education. If you're looking to buy or sell a house right now, you know that the housing market is in a weird place. In Las Vegas, the median price for an existing home in December was $470,000. That's down from the record high of almost $489,000 a month earlier. However, it's considerably more than what a house cost before the pandemic, about $150,000 more. At the same time, the number of those houses, condos, and townhomes sold last year was at its lowest number since 2007. So, if sales are down, why do prices remain so high? And what should somebody who's looking for a new home know? To help us make sense of the market, we're joined now by David Brownell. He's a longtime Las Vegas realtor who has served on the Las Vegas Realtors Board of Directors. He's also the owner of Brownell Team Realtors. David, welcome.
Thank you.
First, let's talk about the state of the market. As mentioned, the median home price in Southern Nevada hit record highs last year. What is the state of the market? Is it healthy right now?
Well, it's a balanced market currently. It's been kind of that for the last 12 to 18 months. You noted that we had a really unique year in 2025. We had the lowest number of sales since 2007, another year of kind of depressed housing sales. But before 2007, it was the mid-1990s before we sold the number of homes that we sold in 2025. So definitely way down. And so that should be a good sign normally in the market for prices to soften, but that's not happening. We noted that prices did decrease from November to December, about 3%, but that was probably just an anomaly because overall, if we look back at 12 months, prices have been pretty stable for the last 12 months.
So right now, I've heard a lot of talk that it's a buyer's market. Is it a buyer's market? Supply seems to be up.
Well, supply definitely is up since last year, but when we only have 8,500 units on the market in Las Vegas in a town of 2.2 plus million folks, that's not a lot. When we're selling 3,000 units a month, we barely have or don't quite have 3 months of inventory at this time. And while it's certainly better for buyers, I wouldn't call that an all-out buyer's market.
What are you hearing right now from clients, both buyers and sellers?
Well, buyers want to buy. There's a number of buyers that are on the sidelines, whether forced there because of the home prices and the interest rates right now and the unaffordability in the market, or just those that don't feel certainty in the market. They want to act, but they're still hesitant. Sellers, they're pretty comfortable. I mean, if I'm in a house where I've got an interest rate that's in the 3% or 4% range, and I'm looking at a higher interest rate, my payment's manageable right now, it's fixed, there's no sense of urgency because prices aren't going down. So the market's still kind of stuck in somewhat of a stalemate.
interest rates, you mentioned a second ago, they're coming down. They are still high. They're coming down, albeit slowly. What's the magic number, if there is one, that incentivizes buyers to buy?
Sure, it's a great question, and there's a lot of speculation on that very topic. I think that before there was conversation that if we could just get interest rates into the fives, that that would inspire some action. But I think the most recent indications are that probably 5.5 or mid-five range is what's going to really trigger a mad rush back to the market by buyers.
You know, we've talked a lot about buying property, but 40% of the population in Nevada rents. Have we seen any big noticeable changes in the rental market?
Well, rent prices have definitely softened over the last 12 months, and that's been helpful for the overall kind of community in Las Vegas because prices had gotten pretty high compared to incomes, even to rent. And so that little softening in that market, I think, has made it better, but prices are still high across the board.
Redfin, the real estate website, reports that 2026 will be the year of the great housing reset. They say that this is the year housing sales will improve, prices will stabilize. You know, do you buy that, or do you think the market is really needing a place to stabilize?
Well, I think that that's a good indication of where we're headed. But I don't know that the word reset is a little troubling to me because I think that takes folks back to maybe some thoughts of 2007 and around that time of the Great Recession. But a reset may be in behavioral and in mindset by both buyers and sellers. I think that 2025 was probably the low point of sales. We expect 2026 to be better with sales. Not sure where prices will go, but early indications are that buyers are coming back to the market and sellers are coming back to the market as we enter into 2026.
We've got about a minute left. Is there something that a first-time home buyer should know about jumping into this market?
Well, you know, it's definitely a market that you need some guidance, I think. Typically real estate is something that I think a lot of the community feels they can handle themselves, but we're in a market that's very different right now, and it's easy to make a poor decision. And so guidance is the thing that I would recommend to first-time homebuyers as they were coming into this market. Find someone you can get to help you and rely on their expertise.
We're going to have to leave it there. David Brownell is a longtime Las Vegas realtor who has served on the Las Vegas Realtors Board of Directors. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
One policy that might shake up the market is ending corporate home ownership. It's an idea some state lawmakers have pitched in recent years, and now President Trump recently signaled an interest in banning or limiting it. To help us understand how a policy like that might work, I turn to Nick Orwin. He's the research director at the Lead Center for Real Estate at UNLV. Here's what he had to say. Nick, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Earlier this month, President Trump posted on social media that he'll take steps to prevent institutional investors from buying single-family houses, claiming the move would help make housing more affordable for Americans. Just how big of a change would this be in the current housing market?
Well, the interesting thing is with this is we don't know because our data is not very good at looking at this question. And the thing that with political leaders all the way from local elected officials all the way to the president himself, when they talk about investors, there's sort of a squishy middle in what we're talking about when we mean investors. Everyone likes to use the word corporate investors, but we don't even have a good definition of what corporate investors are. We would think you'd want to measure them by number of units purchased or the size of your overall portfolio. The one definition that a company, Cotality, who they provide their sort of the go-to person for data on the real estate market, they use the idea of 1,000 units as a mega investor, which they would term those would be your corporate or institutional investors. But is that 1,000 units locally or is that 1,000 units across the entire nation? Because 1,000 units in Carson City versus 1,000 units in Elko, 1,000 units in Reno, 1,000 units in Las Vegas, that's very different versus 1,000 units spread across the entire, Mountain West area. So one of the issues with even understanding if we have a problem is we just don't have good data on this. And part of that issue is when it comes to tracking investors, people, business entities who are buying property, we're mostly relegated to looking at buyer names. And if those buyer names have an LLC or an LLP or corp or something like that we can tag it with, this is some research we've been doing recently at the Lead Center. And I encourage everyone to look at our recent report. We did some analysis of Washoe County in Reno that was just released yesterday. That's available on our website. We try to track these buyers over a 10-year period. And one of the issues that we keep running into is if we observe a buyer name, say it's Homes Incorporated, and they buy 50 houses, but Homes Incorporated 2 is a separately named individual and they buy 50 houses and they're controlled by the same company. We can't observe that in the data. Myself and our director, our executive director, Sean McCoy, have put a lot of work into thinking through this just so we can understand, like, do we have an issue with corporate investing, with investors in town? We don't know, but the first step to understanding is let's look at the data and see what we have. And it's, at least in Washoe County, some of our data suggests that those big mega investors don't seem to be present in Washoe, but you do have, you know, a sizable amount of investor activity.
From your perspective, is there a way to make something like this work?
It's complicated. I think theoretically there's a way, but through, let's say if President Trump would want to do something, I know he's tasked this Treasury Secretary with determining the number of sort of that threshold of what is an institutional investor or a corporate investor. That's the first step. And then one of the issues with this is it's, even if you ask someone like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to sort of be in charge of enforcing this and not allowing large companies to purchase these homes, these large institutional investors aren't using a traditional mortgage product to purchase these houses. They're using some other sort of financing that would harm, though, you know, potentially, you know, local investors, you know, your, what we would call your mom and pop investors, someone who may own like four or five properties. Maybe it's, you know, sort of their plan for retirement. And maybe they're taking out a mortgage on each of those. Those could be the folks that could potentially be caught up in that. Otherwise, it's really tough to interfere with the market, the free market, from folks, you know, wanting to purchase properties. I mean, after all, you know, corporations are recognized as having rights, and the right to purchase property would be right up there with the right to have free speech. Potentially, there's an avenue with tax. If you think about how the depreciation works on assets like housing, there's potentially a way to do that. Locally or on a state level, you could potentially tax them by inventory. If they have a certain number of units, they could pay, you know, an extra tax on top of it. But that comes back to the same tracking issue.
We're in an election year. From your perspective, you know, what do you think state and local policymakers need to do to make homeownership more attainable in Nevada?
Oh, well, a lot of the things that we talk about locally and across the state, we focus often on demand side policies. So these are things to sort of help directly, interventions to help affordability, like first time home buyer tax credits. Those all have potentially inflationary effects because you're putting more money into the demand and some of that money will be capitalized into the house prices. The ultimate thing to do is to increase the supply of housing, help build more housing, bringing more housing online. That puts downward pressure on prices. And I think you can see that in a lot of the places across the U.S. who have increased their supply of housing, your Austins, your Minneapolis, St. Paul's, their year-over-year house price increases are not nearly what we're seeing locally.
Nick Irwin is the research director at UNLV's Lead Center for Real Estate. Nick, thank you.
Hey, appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Flip on the radio or TV in the last few days, and it seems like much of the country is still trying to dig themselves out of the snow and ice from this week's big winter storm. However, out here out west, it's a much different story, which for the most part has remained unseasonably warm and dry. So much so that the Department of Interior this week revised its prediction for water coming down the Colorado River in the coming year. The snowpack in the Rockies, which feeds the river, is less than two-thirds the average for this time of year. So the Bureau of Reclamation has revised its estimated 2026 water year inflow from 68% to 63%. All of this is going on while water managers from the seven basin states are negotiating how best to divvy up the river moving forward. Tracking all of that is Scott Franz. He is the Western Waters reporter for KUNC in Northern Colorado. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hello.
All right, so let's go ahead and talk about the state of the river. We're quickly approaching the tail end of winter. What's the snowpack situation in the Rockies on the ground?
It's really, really bad. I'm actually at a water conference here in Denver, bumped into a rancher I personally know from the northwest corner of our state, who's on the Yampa River, which feeds into the Colorado. I asked her how she's doing, and the first thing she said is, not great. You know, we're having a really challenging water year. She's worried about, you know, the cattle season coming up and the availability of water. When you look at the map across the region, it's orange and red. And, you know, statewide here in Colorado, we're about 58% of our normal snowpack. The state of Utah, I saw today, 94% is in some form of a drought. So we're, you know, in a lot of places at record lows are approaching that for this time of year.
You know, we've had a few decent water years in a row. That said, the narrative during that point was that several good years will not do enough to make up for a bad year. Could we be staring down the barrel of a bad water year?
There's a high likelihood of that at this point. You know, there water managers do like to stress at this time of year that there's a lot of the winter season to go. And, you know, you could get some big snowstorms that dramatically change the picture. But the messaging I've heard this week is that we're really at a point where statistically it's getting harder and harder to climb out of this very poor start, this very concerning start to our winter snowpack season. So, you know, every week that goes by without, you know, major storms or a chain of storms really makes that gap bigger. So there right now is a high likelihood that we are facing a bad year.
Paint me a picture. What is the worst case scenario?
The worst case scenario that we've seen in the forecasts is, lots of impacts to water users, whether it's, you know, mandatory cuts coming in the summer. But there's also a big concern about the levels of our major reservoirs. Lake Powell, you know, there are some forecasts that say it could drop below a point and get so low that it stops producing hydropower, which would be a huge issue. I mean, that would have just such a great impact on so many people across the West. So there are discussions already, you know, with these dire forecasts and this warming trend and where we're seeing snowpack of already, you know, having to take some actions to prevent that from happening.
As I mentioned, all this is going on while water managers are negotiating the fate of the river. They're facing a February 14th deadline to figure out how they're going to share the water in the river after this year's compact ends. However, it seems negotiations are going nowhere. What's going on?
Yeah, so it's crunch time for negotiators, and the updates we've heard in the past week or so have not been promising. I've you know, witnessed that just a couple weeks ago, the negotiators were at a four-day marathon session in Salt Lake City, and afterwards, the reports were Utah's negotiators said they got tired of each other, and they made progress over 2 days, and then that progress was wiped out in a day. And you know, I talked to Colorado's lead negotiator this week. The sense I'm getting is that some states have dug in a little bit at this point. You know, they've been negotiating so long, they floated all these proposals, but they really are still stuck with a few weeks here before a very critical deadline to try and come up with a plan to share and conserve this water as it continues to dwindle because of climate change and drought.
And another sign that talks may have stalled, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum reportedly invited governors from the 7 states in the water basin to attend a meeting in Washington later this week on January 30th. What do you expect from that meeting?
I know that state negotiators are going to be there as well, and they are planning to make their pitch. And you know, Colorado said that they want to stand firm on their position that there shouldn't be any mandatory water cuts in our state. They say they already conserve a lot. So I think they're going to bring a lot of the same talking points, but it will be interesting to have a new political dynamic with the governors of these states being in the same room. You know, perhaps they can reach some sort of agreement or, a change in direction on these negotiations that couldn't happen when you just have the negotiators in the room stuck at an impasse.
Scott, we got about 20 seconds left. What happens if managers don't reach our deadline?
That is the million-dollar question, right? I'm sensing that if they don't hit it by February 14th, it you know, there still will be some conversations and some efforts. I don't think it's a necessarily a hard deadline, but surely a significant date to try and hit.
Scott Franz covers Western Waters for KUNC in Northern Colorado. Scott, thank you so much for the insight.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Philip Glass's operatic treatment of the soundtrack to the 1946 film La Belle et la Bête, otherwise known as The Beauty and the Beast. It's also the inspiration for the latest production by Vegas City Opera. Over 16 seasons, the arts organization has evolved and expanded its audience base, largely by doing things a little differently. Earlier this week, KNPR's Mike Pravat spoke to Vegas City Opera performer and board member Juwan Jenkins, who's also an assistant professor of voice at UNLV. Here's how that conversation went.
Juwan, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So why Beauty and the Beast, and why this specific version?
That's a great question. La Belle et la Bête is composed by Philip Glass, and it's based on the John Cocteau's 1946 film. And what Philip Glass did is he completely stripped the soundtrack to the original film, and he composed his own score, so that the singers are actually singing what the actors would be speaking. So it's synced perfectly with the film so that the audience actually gets a chance to experience a film. They'll experience live singing as well as a small orchestration.
So you'll actually have the film being broadcast while the performers are performing.
Yes, wow. It will be projected.
And is there something about the story or the characters of Beauty and the Beast that lends themselves to an operatic interpretation?
That is a really good question. So in this opera, it's completely different from Disney's Beauty and the Beast. When I was doing some research on it, I found a quote that said, Disney's version tells you how to feel about love, but when Philip Glass, it lets you drift into different ideas. What I really enjoyed with this one is that Beast is kind of characterized a little bit differently. He's more animalistic, but his music is also still legato, and it shows a vulnerable side to him. There's a good arc to his character as well.
When you were given that information ahead of playing the Beast, did you come up with a certain strategy to make sure that your performance reflected that?
It's a little bit different. So in opera, we're doing staging, so we're acting out the scenes. But since this is a concert version, I had to be more mindful of how I want to portray the character just musically. So without moving, I had to think more about, okay, this phrase, I want to showcase maybe how the Beast feels about love or how he feels about Belle and so forth. So it's a little bit different as opposed to if I was actually portraying the character. But I did my best to see if I can match it with what's presented on the film.
So who is playing Belle, and how is she playing Belle?
Yes, so Belle is being played by Courtney Ankerfeld, and she's playing Belle a little bit different from the Disney version. You know, this production it's not the same, but she still incorporates some of Belle's features musically.
With your version of La Belle et la Bête, did you feel empowered to take some liberties to maybe put your or VCO spin on this production?
There's not too many liberties we can actually take because the score is synced perfectly with the film. We can't change the tempos. As singers, we sometimes want to slow down, maybe want to speed up a certain phrase, but we don't have the liberty to actually do that just because it has to be perfectly synced with the film.
You got to be pretty loyal to them.
Yes, yes.
You know, I counted more than 20 different film or TV adaptations of Beauty and the Beast, and the most dominant ones might be, of course, La Belle et la Bête. And as you mentioned earlier, the Disney animated and now live action versions. I'm wondering if a story that's so well known and heavily adapted, is that a blessing or is it a curse when it comes to staging your own version of it? Can audience expectations work for and or against you?
I think it's a little bit harder because the audience is going to come in with an expectation of maybe Disney and they have their own story in mind. But the great thing about our production and doing it with the film is that they're being exposed to, I want to say, a new and old. So new meaning there's new music, a newer composer, as opposed to songs that they might already know from the classic Disney Beauty and the Beast.
Sure. Vegas City Opera is in the middle of the 16th season. This is the fifth of six productions this season. You also put on smaller concerts throughout the year. How did you go about deciding on La Belle and for that matter, the other five productions? I mean, what goes into deciding what you're ultimately going to produce?
I think it's based on a need and also what an audience would like to experience. What I really enjoy about Vegas City Opera is that it's opera outside of the box. So my first introduction to Vegas City Opera was a production of La Baudette, and it was based on the classic La Bohème by Puccini. Now, it's a popular opera, but this one took a different spin on it. It was around shortly after the pandemic, so the main theme was that there was a virus going around through where we were set, and not to give away too much of the story, but things happen within the opera. But it's very different from the actual opera, La Bohème.
I feel like with Vegas City Opera, maybe one of the strategies you have is let's take something that was clearly made a long time ago and let's see if we can modernize it. Would that be fair?
Yes. It's kind of tricky because, you know, there's so many opera lovers who prefer to have things the way that, you know, it was intended on. But I think whenever you're trying to draw in new audiences, and especially younger audiences, it's important to kind of find a way to connect with what's going on now.
Do you find that that works? Are you getting more younger audiences coming in, curious people that maybe wouldn't otherwise go to opera?
Yes, I believe so. And then Vegas City Opera has also incorporated a children's chorus. So having a children's chorus in certain productions, that also brings in not only their parents, but, you know, friends of the family who want to support their family members who are in the shows.
Now, how would you compare this season of Vegas City Opera to, say, last season or previous seasons? What's your feeling about the slate that you have this year?
I think every season, in my opinion, it not only grows in programming, but also for the singers. So last season, I was involved in, we did a production, and it was a song cycle, Songs for Murdered Sisters, composed by Jake Heggie. And this season with La Belle et la Bête, I feel like every season that I actually participate in, I have the opportunity to grow as an artist.
What's your sense of the evolution of Vegas City? So I know you haven't been with the organization that long, but from what you've been able to glean from the company, what has been a big indication of change?
I would say programming. Mm. I think that Ginger continues to not only think outside of the box, but think about what the audience needs, but also think about what artists need. As a singer, I love to continue learning and to continue to challenge myself. I would say that this piece is one of the most challenging pieces that I've had to learn. So I'm very thankful to have that opportunity.
And of course, you're referring to executive director Ginger Lan Van Buren of Vegas City Opera. You know, Juwan, as you kind of referred before, some of the productions have film tie-ins. There's collaborations with Las Vegas Sinfonietta, other, you know, kinds of bells and whistles. I wonder how much of those attract audiences. How much of that is important to people saying, you know what, this sounds like something different and I want to go check it out.
So having the collaboration with the Las Vegas Sinfonietta and other organizations, I think that brings in not only their audience to come see what Vegas City Opera is doing, but it also brings in new audiences who might want to experience, let's say, oh, I haven't heard the Sinfonietta before, but I have heard Vegas City Opera, so I would like to go see this production because it has members from the Sinfonietta. So I think it does serve a purpose of having both and also collaborating with many arts organizations in town.
You know, I read somewhere that someone from Vegas City Opera, they wanted to have the organization perform regularly at the Smith Center. That was a goal they were focused on. Obviously, that hasn't happened quite yet. I'm wondering, is that still a big goal to play the big house? And what other goals are Vegas City Opera focused on for the future?
Well, the Smith Center is a really big venue, but I believe it still is a goal to perform there. There is a new venue, the Third Street Theater, that will be home to Vegas City Opera very soon. There should be an announcement on that coming. But one of the more long-term goals, I would say, is to attract new audiences, but also cater to those who have been, you know, faithful audience members of for the past 16 seasons.
Is it hard to strike that balance?
I think it is, because you still want to make sure you're giving your audience what they want to see, but then also continuing to think outside of the box so that you are able to attract new audiences.
Vegas City Opera's La Belle et la Bête will be staged January 30th and 31st at Charleston Heights Arts Center. We'll have a link with more information about that performance at KNPR.org. Juwan Jenkins is a performer and board member for Vegas City Opera. Juwan, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR senior producer Mike Pravat, who oversees the arts and culture beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
I'm looking at your list of suggestions for this week, and I see you have a list of small music venues from around the Las Vegas Valley. What's going on?
Yeah, we are actually losing far too many of them, particularly in the downtown area where they should be thriving. For instance, we had the Sand Dollar Lounge, the second Sand Dollar Lounge that was at the Plaza Hotel. That's closed. Sin Wave, which was in the Arts District, that had closed. Artifice, which was also in the Arts District, that made way for the Doberman Lounge. On the west side of town, we had Counts Vamped, the bar that focused on hard rock. That had also closed. And it sounds like the downtown Las Vegas Events Center isn't outright closing yet, but and that is obviously a much bigger space, but we will be losing that space ultimately to essentially a parking lot, which means we lose festivals like the Best Friends Forever Festival and Punk Rock Bowling. And then there's Swan Dive, which closed. It's making way for a new concept called Bizarre Bar. And then it's reopening somewhere else on Main Street.
That's a lot going on for a music scene that's not very big.
Yeah, and you know, downtown is known for cheap and reasonably priced musical offerings. And these are the places that host those shows. And they're the places that host the shows that give a music scene its depth. So with all of that said, I want to talk about two venues that have shows that I'd like to recommend. Over at The Usual Place, they have a music festival called Planet Desert Rock Weekend 6, the sixth edition of this festival. That takes place between January 29th and February 1st. And they've got more than 20 of what we'll call heavy rock acts. What do I mean by heavy? This is an amalgamation of or collection of the genres that you could call stoner rock, doom rock, psych rock, metal, blues, progressive rock, classic rock. There's a lot of bands from the U.S., but there's also a lot of bands that are from other countries, and some of them have never played Vegas before. Now, back west on Fremont a little bit is Backstage Bar and Billiards, and on Friday, January 30th, they have a little package of post-hardcore bands, Murals, Thomas Eric and the Oral Burrows, and the opening band Diver. Murals kind of lean progressive, but not in the music genre sense, but in the sense that they address issues such as social justice and mental health. They're a very conscious band. This is their debut live tour. And speaking of the Best Friends Forever Festival, if you like the bands that play that festival that with that kind of emotional dynamic, that post-hardcore, post-punk sound, this show is definitely up your alley. I know people are more and more annoyed with dealing with East Fremont, but I think whatever annoyances that there may be down there, they're worth enduring to keep these independent venues alive.
All right, what's going on over at UNLV? It seems like you've selected a more toned down, maybe more conversational, reflective event.
This is a free event held by our friends at BMI at UNLV. It's on Friday, January 30th, and it's called The Art of Retelling the Truth. The two featured speakers, as it were, are Melissa Fabos and Jamie Hood. They are first-person writers who really dig deep into their pasts, into their feelings, into what makes them tick, and how much all of that is informed by trauma. The trauma part is important to their work because that's where they show how they embody trauma, how it figures into their identities and parallels, you know, various social phenomenon, and how they work it out or deal with it and to contextualize it. The conversation is moderated by 2025-26 BMI Shearing Fellow Isle McRoy. They are an acclaimed novelist, writer, editor, and professor, and They list radical honesty as one of their writing focuses. That takes my attention immediately. And if you are interested in that kind of conversation, as you should be, the link to RSVP for it will be at knpr.org.
And finally, for those looking for something a little bit more loose and fun, Mike, what is In Poor Taste?
You mean besides the memes that I share on social media?
Ha 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 ha.
In Poor Taste is actually the pun intended name of this ongoing wine slash comedy event that is happening Saturday through January 31st at Lighthouse Art Space. That's at the Crystal Shopping Center on the Strip. And I picked this because we've all been paying attention to the news. I wanted to pick something lighter, funnier, something that's a little bit of an escape. And the center of attention includes a wine expert, two comedians, who obviously are not wine experts, and five glasses of wine. This is a wine tasting event, essentially. And by the way, there is non-alcoholic vino available. And the wine expert is guiding everyone through the tasting. The comedians are riffing throughout the experience. Paul, do you remember Statler and Waldorf, the ornery, wisecracking guys that hang out in the balcony from The Muppet Show?
Do I remember them? They continue to be a source of wisecracking inspiration for me.
Yeah, likewise. And I can imagine these two comedians snarking it up in a similar fashion as the wine expert tries to earnestly address the backgrounds of the wineries and the notes of the wine as everybody's sipping. And it actually won awards at one of the fringe festivals in Australia. This is through Saturday, January 31st at Lighthouse Art Space.
That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Paul.